From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. So many things have changed for businesses in the past 2 months.
We have created an instant gratification climate due to COVID-19, saying that I know you used to come out to my store. You can order it right now, and we're going to bring it to you. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing or a good thing. It's just different.
Today, a business owner in Grand Rapids talks about things to consider with reopening. Also, Parks Director Ron Olson on staying safe while getting out this summer.
If you're sick, don't go out. If you do go, pick a place that's close to home to minimize contacts and stopovers like at gas stations and things like that.
And the makers of the pandemic blockbuster horror film The Wretched talk distribution in drive-ins and using the film's success as a springboard for their next project.
It's kind of like the Midwesterner in us. We'll still figure out how to make a movie on our own if none of these possibilities work out for some reason.
Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today on the show, how the parks system is coping with the tidal wave of Michiganders who are just desperate to get out of the house. We'll be talking with Parks Director Ron Olson later in the hour. But first, restaurants and bars all around the state can start dine-in service next week. The question of whether they will varies a bit. We've spoken with a number of businesses in the past couple of weeks about their concerns on reopening. Jermel Eddy is the proprietor of Malamaya Juice Bar in Grand Rapids. We first met him a couple of months ago around the time the lockdown began, and we asked if he could come back and tell us how it's going. Jermel Eddy, welcome back to Stateside.
I am glad to be back. Thank you.
The last time we spoke, you weren't positive that you would be reopening if the ban were lifted. We're getting close to that point now. Where are you with that decision?
Well, you are correct. I was not sure, and there's still lots of unknowns from day to day. We didn't totally shut down. We probably cut back our business by 60%, and so operating on a 40% basis of our offerings, and only we're doing deliveries, myself personally with my vehicle and through FedEx with online orders. Just last Tuesday, we opened up for curbside service, and that's been going well, very, very well. In fact, this past Tuesday, let's see, a couple days ago, there was an initiative that folk in the community got together to do called Blackout Tuesday and supporting Black-owned businesses. And I was here till 1 in the morning making juices for that because we sold so much. People supported us so much that we were backed up with orders and whatnot. And
oh, so wow.
And yesterday was great, too. So the support was there. And it's my hope and desire that for the customers that we've gained some new customers, maybe folk can look and see that, not only are you a Black owned business, you are as good, if not better than some of the other businesses that we've attended, that we've gone to, including great customer service, great product, and just a great atmosphere. And so it's my desire that this is not, so to speak, the flavor of the week, but this is going to be ingrained in people's spending cycles and on in their budgets, that they're going to be spending money at Malamaya Juice Bar and other minority and Black-owned businesses in the community.
Right. I remember you saying that your storefront relies on a couple of different things, not just on walk-by business, not just on the regulars, but a little bit of both. And now there's this new factor of people who, may be very motivated to support Black business in the community. Do you have any sense at this point of how much of each of those customer bases are going to be there for you?
I don't. I would say that we're going to have a decent amount of the customer base, both those who were customers previously and those who are just now learning about who we are and what we stand for. People are going to our websites doing research on the businesses that they want to support. They're looking on Facebook. They're asking friends. And we can stand on a solid foundation of love to say that we are who we say we are and that people feel good about spending their money with Malamaya Juice Bar. And I think for that reason, we're going to continue to excel and grow our business. But we're not just worried about that piece. We're also worried and wanting the same thing to happen to other Black-owned businesses. So we're out there not only hustling for us, for Malamaya Juice Bar, but we're also hustling for other Black-owned businesses and even other minority-owned businesses, wanting to ensure that we don't want to be the only ones to survive. We want to survive together. We can all win and rise together.
What kinds of safety provisions are you starting to think about?
We started thinking about those as soon as all of this hit. Our business has a sneeze guard, for instance, that is part of our requirements to open. And so while a lot of people are spending money breaking the bank, buying plexiglass and putting things like that up in their stores, we have that already in place.
Way to get ahead of the curve.
That's just part of our business practices. We can't even get past the health department if we don't have that sneeze guard up in the beginning.
Uh-huh.
So we have that. We have our masks. We got so many masks, reusable masks, and we wash them daily. But we have quite a few just in case. You know, you never know. You don't want to keep wearing the same one day after day without washing it. So we have that. We send our staff every single day, whether you're working or not. You have to log into a questionnaire, 9-question questionnaire by Spectrum Health that asks your temperature and asks a few other questions. And then the staff has to give us a screenshot of that into a Google Doc folder along with their temperature. And we even have a forehead thermometer right here in case someone forgets to do that when they're at home. We have sanitizer all over the place. And probably for another couple of weeks, we're going to do curbside pickup only. So we're not going to let folk into our storefront just yet. We want to keep this thing going because it's working very well. And then we're going to slowly start to do that. But I want to make sure that first and foremost, our employees feel safe and they're not put at risk. And then we don't want to put anyone else at risk. So when it comes to the whole business thing, I want the business to succeed. Yes, but I'm more concerned about the holistic community wellness and health.
Grand Rapids has had such a crazy week with the marches and the demonstrations. I just wondered how your street was doing, both at home and for Malamaya.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. From a business perspective, there was some damage done to a few stores around us, but nothing happened to Malamaya. And, I think that some of the protests and some of what happened is a long time coming. And again, the protests were very peaceful for a while. And then there was a shift at some point, in demonstration. But, you know, when people feel they're not being heard, they're going to speak louder and they're going to act louder. And that's, I believe, what we saw there. When it comes to my street at home, I'm in the inner city core of Grand Rapids, and it was so peaceful there. When I got back home from some of the protests, some of the demonstrations, it was so peaceful. I didn't even hear fireworks. I didn't even hear neighbors. I think everybody was just peacefully at home, trying to decompress and really mentally go through their mind on what has happened over the past few weeks and how do we move forward. So it was great being home with my wife and watching a movie with my kids and eating popcorn and just kind of relaxing.
Yeah, there's a lot to process.
It is a lot.
Were you downtown to take part in the demonstrations or keep an eye on the storefront or maybe a little bit of both?
Yeah, more so taking part in some of the demonstrations. The one on Saturday, me and a friend of mine met up down there to be a part of that and to stand in solidarity with so many of our community members down there, just really wanting folks to know that for both of us, my friend and I, as African American men, this is important to us, and for the community to also realize how important this is. And you know, I wasn't worried about my store. I wasn't worried about Malamaya Juice Bar. Again, my concern is always being the good of the community. I'm more so concerned about the community's health and the community's wealth. And so I did have friends reach out to me. These are white males reached out to me, good friends that not only wanted to say, I'm sorry about what's going on, they wanted to know how they could take action. And they said, hey, do you need us to come down there and sit in front of your store to make sure nothing happens to it? We'll do it overnight. We will bring plywood. We will put things up and we don't have to pay for it. And that's the type of love that I think we need to see going forward.
Yeah. As you mentioned, you've got kids at home. What do they know about everything that's been happening?
My kids, they know a lot. We may not tell them every single little detail of what's going on, but we talk to them about why we might go to a march or a protest. So going to protest isn't anything new to them. We've done that for immigration, for equal rights for LGBTQ+ communities. And we that's what we do as a family. We want to be who we say we are in private And we want to do that same people in public. And so we talk to our kids about what's going on. And again, at their level, and see if they have an understanding when we're done with the conversation. And it seems that they do, have an understanding, that they do remember and they do know what's going on. My wife, as a social worker, just has ways of communicating to our children. She recently brought to my attention a resource that we purchased called Something Happened in Our Town, a child story about racial injustice. And we went through a chapter of that with our kids. And I would invite any parent to get this resource and look out there in the community and look on the bookshelves and see what you can do, because that's one tangible piece of action, is taking care and educating yourself and your household before you go out telling people what they should and shouldn't be doing. The question is, what are you doing in your house? Whatever you do, do something, and do something positive.
Right. I imagine that, sadly, this is not the first time the kids have seen this come up. Have they had any questions about this round of activity and what happened in Minneapolis and Ypsilanti?
A little bit. They had a little bit of questions. My oldest is 10 years old. Middle kid is 8, and then the youngest is 4. And we're trying to have a serious conversation. My oldest is into it. My middle kid is like, "Hey, are we having cookies for dessert?" and then my youngest is, wanting to play baseball. And so, but there is something there, that the innocence of, what are we going to have for dessert? The innocence of, okay, I hear what you're saying, but can we go play baseball? They're innocent. And we're talking to ourselves, my wife and I, of like, at some point, they're going to be looked at as a threat, not just cute and cuddly, but at a threat at some point. And how do we teach them that that's not okay, but also how not to stereotype other people? And so we want to raise anti-racist boys as well. We want to make sure that they're aware of their surroundings, and we want to give them the tools to act in a very productive way as productive members of the community. And so when they bring up questions, yes, we'll answer them. One of my kids' friends was making a sign for one of the demonstrations, and his mom said, "Hey, what matters to you? What should we put on the sign? What matters to you?" And he's a white young child, and he said, "Nehemiah's life matters to me." And my Nehemiah's my 8-year-old. So even at 8 years old, they're able to see that, to feel the differences, and to see that and know that they want to take a stand. But the parents have to teach them how to take a stand. These are the conversations that we need to be having.
Well, Jamel, thanks for checking in with us. We'll be thinking about your family and about the business. Hope we can catch up with you later this summer, too.
Thank you. I welcome that. You know how to find me.
Jamel Eddy is the owner of Malamaya Juice Bar in Grand Rapids. Up next, the Michigan-born directors of a film that became number one in America during the lockdown. They did it by using the only theaters in operation, drive-ins. That's coming up after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As businesses across Michigan begin to reopen next week, there are a few that will have to remain closed: salons, gyms, and movie theaters. However, Michigan's drive-in theaters have the green light to restart. As the nation's automotive capital, Michigan has a long and storied history with drive-ins. Here's the author of Michigan Drive-In Theaters, Harry Skirdla, talking to us on Stateside back in 2014.
The first drive-in in Michigan opened in 1938, and it was the 10th in the country or in the world. That was the one that became eventually known as the East Side in Detroit. Most of them were built just after the war. Probably between, say, 47 and 50. As I said, it peaked in 58. And at that point, there were probably 3,700 in the country. What killed them essentially was they were constructed of necessity on the outskirts of towns where the property was cheap. Well, these cities kept on growing over the years. And in the case of the Gratiot, ironically, the same architectural firm that designed the Gratiot in 48 was designing the strip mall that replaced it in 85. Well, I went and talked to them at the time, and the senior architect said, The drive-in was still making money, but they gave them $10 million for the property.
Oh, man. Thus ended a much beloved chapter of Michigan movie watching. Strangely enough, though, the pandemic has a lot of people all over the country thinking how very attractive the drive-in experience can be. A pair of Michigan brothers has capitalized on the moment. They directed an independently produced horror film called The Wretched. Under other circumstances, it might have had a hard time competing with other box office releases. But thanks to drive-in audiences across the nation, the only ones open, The Wretched became the number one grossing film in America for several weeks. The film is about a witch who preys on children, imitating moms and other women to reel them in. Here's a taste.
Dylan, I'm down here, baby. Mommy needs help. Come here, sweetheart. Come on, it's okay. Dylan, I'm down here, baby.
Dylan! You're going to be in so much trouble if you don't come here right now.
Listen to Mommy, you little...
Do as I say, Dylan!
Dylan! Hey, don't dip out on me like that. It freaks me out.
That's a clip from the new film, The Wretched. Joining us now are the directors of The Wretched, Brett and Drew Pierce. Welcome to Stateside, guys.
Oh, thanks. Thanks for having us. Thanks, guys.
You guys grew up in Michigan. I know you went to Dondero High in Royal Oak back when it was Dondero High.
Yeah. We grew up in Detroit initially and went to Detroit Open School together. And then our mom moved us out to Royal Oak for the high school days. And graduated high school in Royal Oak. And then Drew went to college at CCS and I went to Wayne State University.
Yeah, true Michigan boys. Yeah. They actually used to show our movies all the time at the main art theater in Royal Oak, this little artsy theater.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
A little indies. We'd shoot really bad movies and then rent the theater out and force all our friends and family to pay to come see them.
Yeah. And you guys have a real genre DNA connection. Your dad did some special effects and indeed worked on Sam Raimi's classic Evil Dead. What did he tell you about that shoot?
That it was a total nightmare.
Yeah, that it was a mess.
Yeah.
We kind of took that away from that. I mean, we've grown up with the lore and sort of idolizing like what Sam was able to pull off. But yeah, it sounds like it was just the worst shoot of all time. And they just kept shooting because they had no idea what they were doing. Sam Raimi, I think, was like 18 years old when he was doing that movie. So
right.
It was just a disaster.
Yeah.
And I think that's sort of what we've taken into all of our projects, just like, not only is it like a bunch of friends and family, but it's also a little bit of a mess, you know?
It's a mess. It's like
our original production.
It's a do-it-yourself kind of mentality, you know? Because with Evil Dead, from our perspective as kids watching them do that, it was like, oh, dad, just, you know, you get your friends together, you know, Sam and Bruce and all these guys, and you figure out how to make your movie in your basements and your backyards or the woods of Michigan, you know?
Well, Evil Dead is kind of the classic example.
Yeah.
What were some other family favorites in horror when you were growing up?
Oh, man. Probably Fright Night was a big one.
Yeah. Right.
Which is really obvious if you've seen the movie.
Yeah, if you've seen the movie.
But
yes.
E.T.
Well, I don't know if that's horror, but like for horror for me,
for a 7-year old,
Yeah. I mean, I was terrified of E.T. I thought he was super scary. I used to have a trading card of him that I couldn't look at because he looked too creepy to me. But it was the original Halloween was really big for Drew and I. Fright Night, Child's Play. I know I love Child's Play. It's a great, cheesy, fun killer doll movie. I think that's why we just like movies about kids in trouble, too, is that, you know, kind of grows out of the Fright Nights and Child's Play films.
Sure. Well, so The Wretched is about a young man who's trying to fend off a witch who preys on children. What elements got your interest about the story?
I mean, it started mostly with Drew and I kind of realizing that the character of the witch didn't really have like rules or a built out mythology that everybody was completely familiar with. There had been a lot of witches in a lot of different films, but it was always kind of nebulous, like how they worked or what they would, or maybe they were just a ghost that murdered children that happened to be a woman. So they would call her a witch.
And we wanted it to feel sort of like vampires and zombies, these movies that have so many rules. They're kind of fun to watch because you know what to anticipate in the scene, you know what to be worried about. So we started digging into like a couple real mythologies. We've read about everyone that's ever existed, but we found these two that were really interesting to us. There's this one called Black Annie or Black Annis. It's this English myth about like a blue-faced hag who steals children and devours them beneath her tree in the woods. Mm-hmm. And then there's another one called the Boo Hag about this skin-stealing, body-swapping kind of witch where you can salt her skin. Like she'd come back at night, you salt her skin and she'd burn alive.
Yeah.
And we just liked those ideas so much that we were like, let's combine these two ideas and make up a few rules of our own that we think just make the movie more exciting. And that kind of gave us our creature witch, which was like, we were super excited about.
What did you talk about with your effects team when you were crafting the look of your villain?
Well, it was great because Drew is a character designer by trade. He's worked on a lot of animated shows like Futurama. So he had made a bunch of drawings of the wretch or the witch way before we even shot the film. When we were even trying to raise money, we had all these drawings we were going around with her to show to investors. And so we just kind of like handed those over and said, this is what we're thinking. What do you think we can actually pull off? And it ended up being this kind of great collaboration because he would do sculpts of the creature. Like he'd be sculpting the face and the chest and the back. And then he would send us pictures because we were in Michigan prepping the movie and he was still out here in LA in his little garage creature
shit taking him.
Yeah. Yeah. And Drew would just draw over the sculpts and say, hey, let's thin out her face a little bit here. Let's make the forehead a little less prominent. So it was this awesome like collaboration where like Drew and the effects guy were getting to kind of like just completely design the creature together at the same time.
That was really cool. Yeah.
For those who haven't seen the movie, the wretch has, I mean, she's identifiably female.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she has like this sort of skeletal look about her. And you did a lot with animal skeletons.
Yeah.
in her construction. Yeah. But like what did you find physically frightening that you wanted to incorporate in like her movement?
Well, a lot of that was brought to we held like an audition for creature actors because we knew we had this sort of particular feel we wanted for the creature, but we just put out this open casting call like with our concept designs and our script little beats kind of attached. And we got back a ton of submissions, half of which were just people like growling at the camera,
yeah.
Looking ridiculous. But a lot of the actual like sort of motion and sort of like
the visual representation where she moved was our actress, Madeline Stunkel, who's actually a Michigan native too. We found her in Chicago at the time because she was just going to school there, but she was originally from Michigan. So she has sent us the coolest tape. She was doing the best monster stuff we'd ever seen. So, and she was from Michigan, so it all made sense.
It's an easy one.
Yeah.
Is there a lot to choose from out there in terms of character actors?
There's a handful of people that like they tend to bounce around and do all the like Guillermo del Toro stuff. You know,
they're like the go-to creature people. Yeah.
There's people with sort of like different deformities that are like way too thin or have like a weird contortion kind of element to them. There's nothing specific. Like the girl we hired, she's actually a dancer and just really, you know, articulate with her body. And she just had a good sense for it.
Yeah, she's kind of a natural for doing this stuff. And she always told us that she just practiced like scaring her siblings by doing these creepy creature movements that she was mimicking from The Ring. So
I wonder what it's like to direct somebody for movement in that way that might be different than directing acting.
I mean, it's definitely a different process because it's a lot more about like blocking and how do they position and what do they do, but it's just like acting. You're trying to give them as much creative freedom as possible at the same time. And it's kind of hard to do when you're trying to get exactly like a 3-second long sort of movement in a particular way.
A lot of it's though, they kind of like with Madeline and even Zara, who kind of plays the possessed witch that has some creepy movements. A lot of it's them showing you what they can do, like even just right before you shoot or the day before. And you're like, oh, wow. That's really cool. And that's, you know, honestly, I just didn't think you'd be comfortable enough to bend that far or push an arm that far. And you kind of embrace that. You just kind of work with them because honestly, they're going to know their bodies and what they're able to push it to do better than you are.
The Wretched had a fantastic run and was the top film in America for weeks. Not to downplay the product, but certainly in no small part due to the fact that it was distributed through drive-in theaters.
Yeah.
And this is a time when people cannot go sit in a theater seat like they usually do. Was that initially part of your plan when you were in pre-production for the film, was to see if as many drive-in theaters as possible would take it?
No, I mean, that'd be great if we were. Yeah. No, it was.
It was more like the IFC. The ship was sinking. So what do we do?
The ship was sinking. We had poured all of our hearts and a lot of hard work into this movie over the course of 3+ years. Then all this hit, and you know, it's hard to get even any limited theatrical is pretty uncommon for most indies. Like more than 90% don't get any kind of release, and we thought we'd be releasing in maybe like 10 or 15 theaters and it'd just be kind of a blip and, you know, eventually we'd come out on streaming. But then, yeah, obviously the pivot that IFC did to releasing in drive-ins, I mean, I don't think anybody even themselves like expected it to blow up the way it had.
But then when it did, what was great is they just kind of embraced it and they're like, well, there's more drive-ins and there's more openings. So let's see, you know, see if more people will show up. And it just, keep it was pushing. Like a snowball. It just kind of kept happening. So, and the cool thing is honestly that created the opportunity for people to give a shot to an independent film that probably has a lot of actors nobody recognizes. But after those first couple of weeks, it became word of mouth that just kind of spread. So
yeah, I think audiences started.
We understand the unique opportunity that we're in, but we're just kind of like, wow. But you know what the thing was? It was able to shine a light on it for just long enough so that people actually knew it was there. So that's what was great.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Brett and Drew Pierce, the directors of the new film, The Wretched. Have you had a chance to experience the film at a drive-in?
Yeah, a couple of times. Yeah. It's great. I got to go on my first date night in months with my wife. I actually had Brett watch my son, who's in the movie.
Yeah, I've gone three
so
times.
I could go.
Yeah. I've gone three times, and it's always, I mean, it's especially with like, you know, how hard it is to deal with the pandemic right now and just the way the world is. It was such a nice relief to go somewhere where it was safe to be in your car and also be outside under the night sky and watch the sunset. As much as I loved watching the movie, I think I loved just being at the drive-in as much.
Yeah, so, just being outside. Yeah. Drew, wait a second. Yeah. We have to back up here. I didn't put it together that one of those boys in the film was your son.
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't think it's giving too much of the film away to say that most of the children in the film end up basically getting eaten.
Not in the best situation.
Yeah.
You mean dinner?
I figured when we were trying to cast like essentially a baby, my son's 3 now, but he was a baby when we shot. And I didn't know who to ask for a baby for an independent movie who like things might end up tragic for.
Yeah.
So I kind of just offered up my own kid.
How did your wife take this?
A little morbid. She's so awesome. She's supportive. She's been great through the whole thing. But I feel like there has been like a lot of hard, long nights and lots of hard work that she's, you know, had to deal with hanging out with the kid. So I think it justifies it that much more to her because, you know, she's like, my baby was on Good Morning America the other day, looking cute. So it sort of validates the whole thing.
He knows he's a movie star. Yeah. He's seen himself on TV.
You know, you kind of alluded to the fact that a lot of people may have seen this film than maybe otherwise would have under a normal situation.
Yeah.
Just because of the drive-ins and the fact that people have so few options to go out and see some entertainment right now. And maybe also some critics might have looked at it differently than otherwise they might have.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of doors has this opened for you in the future?
It's opened a lot for us, just especially in the last month. We've been taking a lot of Zoom meetings about pitching on things, but also pitching other concepts that we want to make. And honestly, the funny thing is, Drew and I never had these opportunities before. It literally like blew the doors open. And given like, you know, you never know if any of those things are going to work out, but Drew and I are, you know, we're feeling positive, feeling good about those things. But at the same time, it's kind of like the Midwesterner in us. We'll still figure out how to make a movie on our own if none of these possibilities work out for some reason.
Sure.
So, yeah. Sure. Yeah. But it's been great.
So if folks cannot get to a drive-in anytime soon, is there a place that they can see it on the small screen?
Yeah, we've been on VOD, which means you can rent the film on iTunes, Amazon, PlayStation Store, Xbox, pretty much any VOD service, including your cable service. So it's pretty much everywhere.
Where do you put the goalposts right now? There are so many options in terms of the kind of deals people can make for themselves, you know, streaming services and, you know, limited series versus, you know, single shot releases, not to mention that thriving drive-through market that just isn't quitting anytime soon. What kinds of aspirations do you have?
I think our like first true love is just films, just movies, features, but we love all sorts of storytelling. We just love the process, every little bit of it. We love writing, we love storyboarding, we love editing. Like, that's the exciting part about being a filmmaker. And I think it's the thing we love is there's so many different types of things you get to do along the process. And like, even now, like we really enjoyed being part of the marketing and sort of spreading the word and sharing this movie. Yeah.
Like, I think we just want to, like, with The Wretched, we got to have like a lot of creative control, and it was such a good creative experience for us that whatever we get to make next, we just want to make it with people that support us creatively and are part of the process with us. And just, we just want to make another movie that we're proud of and that we like. I mean, that's always the goal, you know, however it comes out is cool, but you know, we want more people to see it if possible.
Can you tell us what's in production?
Well, it's not in production, but it's something we're trying to push to happen. We really want to make a new take on the werewolf myth. We got really excited about the witch thing when we did The Wretched, and now we have a take on the werewolf that's super unique that we're really excited about. So we're hoping that's the next one, but you know, you never know. Maybe it's Wretched Part 2. Who knows?
Well, our guests have been Brett and Drew Pierce. They are the directors of The Wretched, which is seen at some drive-in theaters, although I'm sad to report Michigan's drive-ins are not quite there yet in terms of reopening. Guys, thank you so much. The film is really fun. Although not exactly a family feature.
Yeah, not a family movie.
I do keep on encouraging to let parents let their kids watch it, which I don't know if that's right or wrong, but I'm like, it's got teenagers in it. It's fine.
Man, that's nuts. That's just nuts. We're looking forward to their productions in the future. Please stay safe, guys, and have a good summer.
You too.
Thanks, you too.
Thank you.
Arts and culture coverage on Stateside is supported in part by an award from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up after the break, State Parks Director Ron Olson has a few ideas about how to get outside without reversing the reductions on COVID-19 infection. It's going to be a great weekend to be outdoors, so do stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. As the weather improves and the kids get closer to the official end of the school year, you may have found yourself thinking about where you can and cannot go in the weeks to come. There's no question Michiganders are hitting the trails in greater numbers. The Department of Natural Resources manages 13,000 miles of trails and 1,300 boat launches. And Ron Olson is chief of Park and Rec for the state of Michigan. Ron, welcome to Stateside.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity.
Ron, do we know how many people have been visiting state parks during physical distancing?
Well, we do keep track of numbers that I don't have the exact number is handy right now, but we do know that even though camping has been suspended, the number of day users or people coming out has accelerated beyond what's normal, even on marginal weather days. We do know that as you get closer to warm weather, we do have lots of people that come out, but we have observed definitely maybe a better way to say it is a clear uptick in the normal visitation that we would have, particularly over the last 6 or so, 7 weeks.
What has reopening looked like for state parks and beaches?
Well, it has been a challenge. First of all, we were paused because of the essential work regulations and things like that. Plus, we had a hiring freeze. So our parks were being managed by our staff that we have that carry through the winter. So it was okay in the first part because the weather was kind of off, but we did restrict access to some of the amenities in the park, such as children's playgrounds and fishing platforms and any area where people might gather. All of our events were suspended. Plus, of course, the camping was paused or suspended as well. So it really changed the types of uses, even though a lot of folks still came out and hiked and biked and different things like that. Plus the boating activity as fishing picked up, we had very, very busy boat launches. And in some of the areas, we had a hard time getting what's called a skid pier, or the piers pushed out in the water to accommodate the boaters because those activities were something we couldn't do for a while. But then eventually things got better and We now have are hiring people back, but everything in a nutshell became delayed from what we normally would be doing.
Sure.
And so that overall has created a challenge.
Sure. Now, the governor is still asking that people observe physical distancing even as they get out and enjoy. To what extent can DNR patrol what's going on? What happens if people disobey physical distancing?
Well, first of all, we've put up signs, and particularly at busy parks, we've even gone so far as to put up the kind of highway construction signs that are very clear when you come in to say that, you know, social distancing is required. For the most part, we've had good compliance with that. It's evolved over time, but we've observed in many, many places it's been abided by most people, not perfect everywhere. But in terms of some areas, we did escalate enforcement at a few areas where we were having some trouble. And our law enforcement staff were involved with this. And of course, as you know, the executive orders do bring with it up from a $500 to $1,000 fine. And there's only been less than 10 tickets given out throughout this whole time.
Now, is that because there have been fewer than 10 serious incidents, or just a function of the fact that you can't be everywhere at once?
No, these are what I'm trying to say is that we've had warnings given to hundreds of people and groups. We've also had probably in the near 1,000 now contacts, which meaning basically that they would tell somebody to please separate and things like that. And warnings have been, if you don't separate, you could be subject to a ticket, and people then have complied. Less than 10 cases we've had actually gave tickets out to people because they've just refused to comply. Now, at Tippy Dam Recreation Area, which is now reopened last Friday, it was closed for almost a month because it was a very popular fishing area and people fish shoulder to shoulder there. And we had an awful time warning people and explaining it. People would separate because they fish along the river and that sort of thing. And finally, we had to close it. Also, at Grand Haven State Park, we closed the parking lots a few weeks ago on a weekend because we had an impromptu car show that created some people gathering, and they refused to separate. And
wow!
Like that.
How many people did that draw?
Oh, it was hundreds of people, and they were all clustered into the parking lot, looking at these cars. Of course, we would not have permitted an activity like that, but it really got out of hand because of the fact that people wouldn't voluntarily separate. So we, working with our law enforcement, closed all the lots to Grand Haven, and we collaborated with the city of Grand Haven. We since have reopened the Channel parking lot, which is a smaller lot, but the large lot has yet to be reopened. But other than that, busy parks like Belle Isle and Detroit, we've had just an overabundance of people wanting to go there, and we've closed the park a few times only because of overcapacity of cars, but not because of social distancing issues.
Is your staff, I don't know what kind of capacity you'd have for this, but is your staff in any position to sort of monitor social networks and try to look for references to people gathering in large numbers in places, or do you just have to sort of react to what staff see on the ground?
Oh, we keep track of all that. We look at social media. We pay attention to what's going on. We have good relationships with the local communities as well as some others. We do collaborate. For a while there, a lot of the rural communities up in the northern part of the state were worried about tourists coming and bringing the potential of the virus coming in, stopping at gas stations, that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
So we do have a multi kind of reach out collaborative way of keeping track to the best of our ability of things that may be coming our way or possibilities. But again, for the most part, we already kind of know where the busy areas are going to be. And so we've concentrated on those areas as well.
What are lake levels looking like at this point in the year?
Oh, they're very high. They're higher right now than they were last year at this time. And we've had a lot of impacts to areas. Just like last year, we've got, we saw pictures over the weekend of East Tawas or Tawas State Park, and the day use parking lot is flooded now. And we've had some campsites flooded, and we've had boat launches that are flooded to the point where they can't be used. We've had damage to harbors. So, yeah, it's definitely created problems, notwithstanding erosion on the shorelines and the loss of beaches and things like that. And we've inventoried all over the state, but that's been evolving over the last probably three years plus now, as the water levels have steadily risen. And that's not just on Lake Michigan, it's Lake Superior, it's Lake Huron, and even down in Lake Erie, we've had problems all over. So it's a big challenge. Plus on Belle Isle in Detroit, the Detroit River has swelled, and we have flooding on the east end of the park that has threatened some features in the park as well. So we've got that going on too.
We've reached this point in the state where contact tracing is going to be an increasingly important way to maintain the reopenings that the state has been able to achieve. How does that work at places like beaches and parks?
I guess you got to start at the very basic, the very beginning of this, when the first executive orders were put out about curtailing and stay-at-home order, the very first one. It did mention in there things that were under the essential category, and state, county, and local parks were identified as essential areas, as provided that they were maintained in a sanitary, safe fashion. And so we started with that, and we urged people to recreate close to home and you come out and enjoy yourself with the restrictions that I already mentioned. From there, things have evolved, and as the orders have evolved and changed and things have opened up more, we've evolved with it. And as time goes on, we keep track of the benchmarks, but there's still the stay-at-home order, and so therefore some of the traveling activities we still emphasize to recreate close to home, and camping is still not allowed, but we've prepared restart plans for that, and we're discussing that. Our target date, it's not a firm date right now, is to reopen camping fully on June 22nd, which would mean that would be part of the evolutionary process.
But I can only imagine what the reservation line is going to be like.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've already had hundreds and hundreds, literally thousands of cancellations that have occurred that people had booked between late April and all the way through Memorial Day through the 22nd of June. So we've been very, very busy trying to encourage people to delay their booking to a later time in the summer. And we even incentivized that by providing a free camp night. But then there's been a large number of people that simply canceled their reservation, which camping is a very important part of funding the state park system. And so it's very critical, the revenue piece. So we have lost revenue, and we're hoping that, you know, people will choose to come back and go camping later and things like that. But it is challenging, no doubt.
Ron, you mentioned that you'd like to ask people to consider recreating closer to home in order to limit any future spread of the virus. Do you have any other advice for Michiganders who might be hoping to spend a day at the beach soon?
Well, all we're saying, we've repeated this many a time, is that if you're sick or don't feel well, don't go out. Second, if you do go, pick a place that's close to home to minimize contacts and stopovers like at gas stations and things like that. The third is, when you get there, to be patient and take your time, try to park in a spot separated from other people and things like that. But then when you do get to a spot, for example, on a beach, separate yourself and, you know, more than 6 feet. I mean, that's a minimum advice, but We've seen at some of the parks already on warm days where people have separated themselves out into their family or group clusters, and now you can gather with up to 10. But to do that and just to be reasonable, and if everybody does that, we won't have any problems. The other piece that we say is bring your masks and bring your personal sanitizers and things like that. Right now, there is no not running water at the parks. To when you go to the bathroom, it's a portable toilet, and we can't guarantee that there'll be sanitizers in there. We tried, but some of them have been taken and things like that. So be prepared for your kids and family and others that are with you, friends, that you're prepared to come. And the other piece is that we've had a lot of trouble with refuse. And if you have gloves or your personal refuse, we're asking you to please make sure you deposit it in a receptacle or a dumpster in the park or take it back home with you so that we don't have discarded litter around, because that creates more unsanitary situations, and it also creates a lot more work to try to keep up, and it creates a visual blight in the parks too. So those are some of the main common sense things, other than the plethora of safety things such as being mindful of cold water, and if it's real wavy, to be careful not to go in the water because of rip currents, and pay attention to the flags that are flying. If they're red, don't go in the water, and all the other safety protocols that you would normally do when you go to a beach.
Well, Ron, thank you very much for your time, and thank you for all the work you and your staff are doing to try to keep our resources open and safe for everybody.
Yes. Okay. Well, I appreciate it.
Ron Olson is Chief of Parks for the State of Michigan. If you're out near Fenville on the west side of the state, there's an organic blueberry farm owned by writer Joan Donaldson and her husband John. It's called Pleasant Hill Farms. They also have a large plot of wildflowers growing nearby. It is just incredible to look at the photos, poppies and much more as far as the eye can see. The flowers are not only feeding the bees right now, they're also nurturing the soul. Joan sent us this essay.
Last summer, a dozen cars lined my driveway as 30 or more people viewed our field of wildflowers. Starting at dawn and continuing to sunset, the visitors reveled in the swaying blossoms. 20 years ago, our son's beehives prompted us to plant wildflowers, but now we grow them for both pollinators and humans. When our sons were in high school, they expanded their love of beekeeping into a small business, and they tended over 80 hives. Their bees had 40 acres of blueberry blossoms to pollinate, but once the spring sources of nectar dwindled, there came a period called a nectar valley, when the bees could find little food. The most appealing solution was to plant acres of flowers. Come late October, John mixed the seeds of red poppies, cornflowers, oxeye daisies, and black-eyed Susans, and poured them into our antique seed drill. He rumbled across the prepared land, and in a few weeks, tiny seedlings sprouted. During the winter, snow blanketed the earth and protected the baby plants. When warmer weather returned, the plants rose, and in late May, flower buds formed. At first, cornflowers dotted the landscape with blue. Next, a few red poppies opened, and soon a shimmering vista of red, blue, pink, and white erupted. When the summer flowers faded, the black-eyed Susans turned the field golden. For many years, only our friends knew about the field of flowers because we planted them near our son's hives. When our boys left home, we continued the tradition to feed pollinators. 2 years ago, we sowed the flowers on our land bordering the Fenville Cemetery. By word of mouth, people learned about the vista and created a traffic jam on the narrow cemetery roads. Photographers captured the site. Artists set up easels. And parents arranged their children and clicked a picture. Comments and thank you notes arrived on the Pleasant Hill Farm Facebook page. A photographer celebrated how his photo won an international award. And an artist told of her painting winning a competition. Other people told how they had driven over 2 hours to see the flowers, while others came to share a picnic during the sunset. If folks ran into us, they would ask, "Why do you do this?" I explained how we wanted to feed pollinators such as bees, butterflies, and other nectar-loving insects. And especially this year, we desire to sow beauty and share it with countless others, wanting the stunning power of flowers to bring them peace and fill them with hope.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week.